Today, El Salvador's draconian abortion laws get a legal challenge through the shocking case of one young woman called Imelda Cortez. And in opinion, The Guardian's chief leader writer Randeep Ramesh explains The Guardian's view on why it's time to bring the question of Brexit back to the people.
We just were crying of happiness. We could not believe that the justice had been done.
In Central America, groups of women are celebrating an unexpected victory.
That is how uncommon it is to get justice in El Salvador, that when you get it, you are so in shock that you think there's something wrong, that maybe we didn't hear correctly, because it was impossible that finally somebody believe what we had been saying for years, and is that an obstetric emergency is not a crime.
El Salvador is one of 26 countries with a total ban on abortion. The law is applied brutally. It's not uncommon for women who have miscarriages or stillbirths or any serious complication to be charged with murder. And that's why a recent court ruling setting 20-year-old Imelda Cortez free was such a shock. Today, in the capital, San Salvador, a judge will formalise the decision to release her. It's a ruling that offers hope in a country notorious for its machismo culture and restrictive treatment of women. From The Guardian, I'm India Rakesson. Today in Focus, this is the story of Imelda Cortez and what her trial means for the women of El Salvador. Before we begin, you should know that Imelda's story involves disturbing accounts of rape and trauma. You may find some of it upsetting.
When you talk to Imelda, even though she's 18, you find a level of innocence in her that it's so hard to believe that someone who has suffered so much can still be so innocent.
From the age of just 12, Imelda Cortez was repeatedly raped by her stepfather. She was 18 when she became pregnant, and 19 when she was charged with attempting to kill her newborn daughter. Paula Avila Guillen, director of Latin America initiatives at the New York-based Women's Equality Center, was part of Imelda's legal team and worked closely with Imelda. She told us her story.
Imelda lived in a very small canton, which is not even like a real village. It's smaller than a village. And she was going to school and she was trying to do as much as she could with her life in very poor conditions. One day she was at a school and she passed out. The school called the mother. The mother took her to the doctor to see what was going on. The doctor ran a few tests and the doctor said, "You have a urinary infection. You are anemic. But I cannot give you any of the treatments for any of those conditions because you are also pregnant." Imelda,
so she didn't know.
She didn't know. She didn't know. And this was very early on in her pregnancy. She left home. Her mom was very upset with her, punished her for being pregnant, told her who was the boyfriend. She keeps saying, I don't have any boyfriend.
Did the mother know about the abuse from her stepfather?
No, the mother says that she didn't know. However, a lot of the neighbors knew. They knew even the place that was like an abandoned construction where the stepfather would take Imelda to rape her.
Did Imelda tell anybody about the abuse?
No, at that point. And one of the reasons why she never did it was because the stepfather kept telling her, "If you ever say anything, I will go to kill your mother." So Imelda just kept it quiet. She was so afraid.
So when she found out that she was pregnant, when her mother found out, what happened to her then?
Because Imelda was anemic and had infections and urinary issues, well, she kept bleeding. She bled during times, clearly wasn't menstruation, but it was some bleeding that she confused as menstruation. So when she bled a few weeks later, the mother and Imelda say, well, the doctor was wrong. you are not pregnant. Also, Imelda told the stepfather when this happened that the doctor had said that she was pregnant, and the stepfather said, well, the doctor is lying. So everybody in the family just assumed that the doctor was wrong. Her body didn't change as much. She gained weight, but she didn't gain a belly. So it was easier for them to believe that the doctor was wrong than to accept the implications of the fact that she was pregnant and that she was going to be pregnant of her stepfather.
And then what happened? How did she end up in hospital?
She had suffered from pains, like she had IBS, colon pains, she had the urinary infection. So it was normal for her to feel like a pain in the lower part of the body, around the uterus and around her vagina. And then she felt like a strong pain that she describes as having to have a very strong need to defecate, like very powerful. She rushed to the latrine, so there is no real bathroom, it's an outside latrine, and she feels that something comes out of her. She doesn't know what it is, but something very painful. She starts crying and bleeding, and she's able to scream to her mother for help before she passes out. Her mother rushed to the latrine and finds her bleeding on the floor, and the mother rushed to try to get a cab to take her to the hospital. She just kept repeating, something came out, but they didn't hear or saw anything, and their only worry was Imelda, who was bleeding a lot. They take her to the hospital, and in the cab, actually the placenta comes out. And when she arrived to the hospital, the doctor said, you either had an abortion or you give birth, but where is your baby? What do you do with it? And Imelda is half unconscious at this point, has lost tons of blood, cannot really answer most of the questions. She's incoherent, and the doctor sends the police to Imelda's house.
When the police arrived at the latrine, what did they find, Paula?
When the police arrive, they are walking around the latrine. They don't hear anything, but one of the policemen hit the outside of the latrine, and then a baby starts crying. And the police rescues the baby. The baby clearly had suffered a hit in the head, but beyond that, the baby was healthy and alive. They rushed the baby to the hospital, and that's when they start accusing Imelda. They say, well, you tried to kill your daughter. When you look at the records afterwards, you realize that Imelda received 2 liters of blood transfusion because she had lost so much blood. And it was during that time that she was being interrogated by doctors and prosecutors. So she clearly wasn't coherent. And even when you read some of the doctor's notes, they say she doesn't seem very coherent. However, the prosecutor cited that she was trying to hide something. Since that moment, Imelda gets handcuffed in the hospital bed. And it's at the hospital that the whole story about she being abused of her stepfather comes out. So what happens is the stepfather shows up at the hospital and threatens Imelda and tells her, if you say anything about what I do to you, that he's going to kill her mother and the civilians. And then because she was sharing a room with other patients, it was another patient, the one who heard this threat and told the nurse and say, look, there is something wrong. He was threatening this girl. And when the nurse came, and it's a nurse they had built some rapport with Imelda, tells her, why you don't tell me, please, what is happening? And then it's when finally she breaks down and confesses and tells the story that he has been raping her for this long time. And even though the nurse calls the prosecutors and say, look, we have a girl that is the victim of rape, we need to do something about it, the initial reaction from prosecutors is to believe that she's just making up that story to try to hide the fact that she was trying to get rid of the baby or she was trying to terminate her pregnancy.
So what was Imelda charged with?
At that moment, Imelda get charged with attempted homicide.
Imelda was held in prison for more than a year before her case came to trial in December. Journalist Nina Lacani has reported extensively from El Salvador over the last several years, and she's seen the consequences of the total ban on abortion.
So this is a law, this is a policy which has disproportionately affected poor women. Young, They're poor, they're from rural areas, they haven't had access to sex education. Access to contraception has been really limited. They're the common themes.
Nina told me that, as horrifying as it was, in many ways, Imelda's story wasn't unusual for El Salvador.
It's become one of the most dangerous and precarious places in the world to be a woman and to be a young person in general.
And what are El Salvador's abortion laws?
So prior to 1997, you had a period of a few decades where reproductive rights were becoming more open because there was a recognition by the medical and scientific community globally that in order to bring down maternal mortality rates and infant mortality rates, you had to have choice. You had to have reproductive rights. In 1997, after what you can only be described as a shady campaign by the right-wing ruling party, ARENA, there was a reform proposed in Congress to implement a total ban in abortions. And this was done without any consultation with the public, no debate, no consultation with medical professionals about what the consequences would be. That became law in 1998. And in 1999, which was really a critical thing, the constitution was amended to define life from the moment of conception. And so since then, so 20 years now, there has been no access to safe abortion in El Salvador. And that law has disproportionately affected poor women. Because if you have money, you can travel to a neighboring country to access a safe abortion.
How do you react when you hear of another case of another woman being taken through the courts for a miscarriage or for having a child?
I think just the cruelty of the way these women are prosecuted, there is an assumption of guilt. So many of these women are prosecuted on the flimsiest of evidence using discredited science. You get this really sort of strong feeling that these women have one role in life, to give birth, to procreate. And the fact that they were unable to fulfill that role, whether it be for a medical complication or for lack of access to antenatal care, they should be punished. In many of these cases, the coroner was unable to determine the cause of death of the fetus. But there's an assumption by the prosecutor and the judges, well, the woman did something to end that fetus's life.
Nina, you've been reporting on Imelda Cortez for quite some time now. What did you first make of her story?
Every case I've reported on, and I've probably reported on like 10 women's cases, it's horrific, it's outrageous in its own way. But Imelda's case, really, her story is just so, so cruel on so many different levels. You know, a young woman who has been sexually abused by a violent stepfather for 7 years, gives birth and is then charged with attempted murder. The fear that that young woman has been subjected to since she was a little girl is so awful. But the prosecutors refused to see her as a victim. So a year after Imelda was in jail, they finally get round to arresting her stepfather. These aren't cases that happen because of the odd bad prosecutor or the odd bad judge. These are symptoms of a system that's designed to work like this.
That is absolutely heartbreaking. Nina, tell me about Imelda's trial.
Imelda's case was meant to be heard in November, and the prosecutor didn't show up, didn't send in a sick note, but let the court know an hour or so later after she was meant to be there that she wasn't coming because she had a sore throat, condemning her to another month rotting in a jailhouse. In that month, the international pressure just got pumped up. You know, we wrote a story in The Guardian, other media wrote stories, human rights groups and reproductive rights groups across the world just started pounding the pressure on El Salvador. And I think the Attorney General's office and I think the prosecutors and the courts really started to feel this pressure.
By the time the court reconvened on Monday, December the 17th, Imelda's case was a global story. And the first thing that happens on the morning of the trial is that Imelda's charge is lowered from attempted murder to abandonment. Imelda's legal team and family are pretty surprised. They're also cautiously hopeful that she might be released for time served. But then the judge takes a break. Imelda's attorney, Paula Avila Guillen, was in the courtroom when he returned to announce his verdict.
He started talking about homicide, and I am freaking out. I am looking around and seeing, like, what is he doing? Is why he's talking about homicide? Why he's not talking about the abandonment of the child charge? Like, what happened? And then he just started changing the speech and say, and in this case, we are talking about how giving birth, and especially giving birth under those circumstances, is a traumatic experience. How Imelda was the victim of abuse and how traumatic it could be that for a girl of this age. Then he says, well, somebody after that trauma in those conditions could have not been capable of committing any crime. Therefore, I am absolving her of all charges. And wow. We all just look around. And I think that he realized that we were not sure if he was saying what he was saying, because then he repeated again. And he said, somebody who is passed out, who has lost so much blood, is not capable of committing any crime, and it doesn't have the capacity to do it. Therefore, she is absolved of all charges and she can walk free.
What was the reaction to that?
I mean, I think that we were all shocked. We also had been warned before that if we had any emotional reaction to the outcome of the case, we will not allow to enter the courthouse again. So we were all trying to be very quiet, but we were like literally on shock. I just got close to the attorneys in one moment, and I was like, did he absolve her of all charges? And then we just start crying.
How did Imelda react to the news?
She started crying immediately. She just was in shock. And when we got out and we told her mother was just like, her mother and her grandmother, they were just bawling her eyes, crying and thanking God and everybody. That was their reaction. And we just were crying of happiness. We could not believe that the justice had been done.
Wow. I mean, what a turnaround from attempted homicide in the morning.
Yeah, I mean, honestly, I was in tears, you know, just thinking, we did not expect this to happen. And the judgment was so good and really a ray of hope in what really feels like a very hopeless situation in El Salvador.
Do you think this is a precedent, or is there a chance that it is just a one-off, just one judge's decision?
Well, but that's how precedents are made. You know, the lawyers now will use this as case law to argue other cases. This is how laws are changed.
Nini, you write so much on human rights, on women's rights. Do you see the world moving towards more rights for women or away?
I think El Salvador, Central America, you know, they are particularly repressive countries. They're violent countries in general. Many of them have come out of civil wars where the US, you know, has played hugely destructive roles, and they've never really recovered from that, because after that you've had, you know, economic policies which have sort of, you know, made things spiral out of control. So I think these are countries with specific sets of problems. But I think that what we're seeing is that repressive authoritarian sort of policies that target women, indigenous people, people with few resources, I think we're seeing a wave of that across the world. Human rights and reproductive rights are human rights, are something that we have fought for, but we fighting for them isn't enough. We have to fight to keep them, because there is a constant pushback, you know, to try and take these rights away.
Nina, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Imelda is now adjusting to life outside of prison and working with a therapist to try to start healing some of the trauma. She's gradually reconnecting with her daughter, and she's hoping to go back to school. You can read all of Nina Lacani's reporting on Central America and Mexico for The Guardian at theguardian.com. Coming up, how we might be able to get the issue of Brexit back in the hands of the people. Now, The Guardian's editorial column has made its case for a way to break the deadlock on Brexit. The suggestion is a representative sample of 100 members of the public selected to form a citizens' assembly. Randeep Ramesh, The Guardian's chief leader writer, tells us how it could work.
So Parliament has failed, the government has failed, and Mrs May's deal to leave the European Union doesn't look as if it will command parliamentary support. The Guardian thought a way of reconciling these divisions would be a citizens' assembly, because it's set up as a sort of deliberative mechanism to allow people to come together. They are selected at random, but designed to be electorally representative. There's a chair who moderates the debates, and then they draw evidence from experts who come and say, well, this is the problem that you're facing, and this is how you could deal with it. And they take the evidence and then debate amongst themselves, rather like a jury does when it's considering a crime in a court. And that process of deliberation allows that group to come to a consensual view around what the next step forward is. We thought, because it had worked in other places, specifically in Ireland where it was set up to deal with five major issues ranging from electoral reform to eventually abortion, which is the successful referendum model that we wanted to look at, that actually ran quite well. And that's partly because the arguments that had no basis in fact had been diffused by the process of a citizens' assembly. So one of the important things about setting up a citizens' assembly is not to define its outcomes, because that would be pointless. And our view still remains that a reformed Britain in a reformed European Union, because the European Union itself needs substantial change to make it work, would be the best outcome. That's just one point of view from one expert, if you like. And the point of a citizens' assembly is to allow people to sift through all the points of view and come to a consensual view, something that everyone can agree on. And so that was why we left it open. And we also left it open whether there should be a referendum or not, because the process by which we arrive at a referendum is as important as a referendum. Hence the need for a deliberative mechanism that isn't what we're seeing in politics right now. And that's the problem, because we can't have a reasoned debate when you have such a polarized debate on ideological grounds, where party loyalty and tribal loyalty means you can't sort of think outside of the box. Our problems with a referendum were, when we discussed it internally, was that the referendum may be the device that has been used to get us here, but it wouldn't be necessarily a very useful way to get us out, in the sense that they're incredibly divisive things, they're open to manipulation, our laws are plainly deficient when it comes to handling these kind of processes. And there seemed to be, we needed a moment of reconciliation, really, because people needed to have faith in the process that got us back to a referendum. Now, if they just saw a bunch of squabbling politicians unable to resolve a question and then think, oh, well, we'll come back to the people because we can't solve it, then I think they'd be fairly angry about why they've been asked again essentially the same question. Our readership is obviously quite Remain-y. So I think people are looking for an answer, for an idea, because we're at that moment. And I think that's why we did it.
And you can read the full editorial at theguardian.com. That's it for today. My thanks to Paola Avila-Guillen, Nina Lacani and Randy Ramesh. Today's producers were Mithili Rao and Elizabeth Cassin, with sound design by Axel Cacoutier. The execs are Phil Maynard and Nicole Jackson. We'll see you tomorrow.